And we are back with Barry Silverthorne and Greg Green. They're talking about what it costs to produce End of Suburbia, their documentary that is kind of taking the country anyway by storm lately. And how difficult was it? Barry, you want to just start off with this?
Well, initially we wanted to produce a documentary about oil, and it quickly became a mega project, bigger than the two of us. So we approached a couple producers who might be able to find us a broadcaster, and they looked at our treatment of the documentary and said, well, you know, no one's going to want to hear this doom and gloom story unless you have a happy ending. And we couldn't give them that, so, you know, we decided to do it on our own. We basically pulled our Visa cards out of the wallet and proceeded to max them out for a year and made it that way.
Yeah, that's what Barry said at our first screening. Was we'd like to thank our funders, Visa and MasterCard. So that's
what did you use for equipment then? What were you using?
That was you know where we were quite lucky because Barry is an editor at Vision TV, so and has his own Avid suite, which is the sort of state of the art broadcast editing suite. So we were able to use that. Barry, you know, just worked his arse off for a year, late nights at the edit suite in between his other edits at Vision, and that was really tough on him. It was a lot of work.
Out of curiosity, what's in your suite? What software programs did you use?
Well, for those who are interested, it's an Avid Media Composer, which, as Greg said, is an industry, you know, standard for editing. But you know, we probably could have done it on you know any system if you know we had the patience. In our case, we had a large amount of footage to go through, a lot of vintage stock footage that had to be cataloged and sorted out. So I think having the power to do that, the software allowed us to do that. But most of the documentary was shot on Greg's DV Canon camera. And, you know, we begged and borrowed equipment to you know, do some other shooting along the way. A little bit of Betacam for those who...
But most of the footage we shot in the U.S. was shot with the Canon because we didn't want to take a bigger, you know, Betacam across the border. Because there's all sorts of grief about going to the U.S.
spy
with the camera.
Here,
yeah, basically, took my little Canon XL1 at the time, and
yeah, for all they knew, that we were just going to videotape a wedding.
That's
you know,
what we kept saying.
Wedding.
Going to a wedding.
Yeah. So we had one light and a couple of microphones, and sometimes I look at the footage and go, you know, we could have done much better. But I think under the circumstances, you know, two guys with you know enough equipment to fill a gym bag, you know, it looks pretty good.
Pretty inspiring for the independent filmmaker that wants to make their own documentary, so that's good to know.
Well, know, when I was in school, I could only dream of having, you know, my own equipment and having the freedom to do this kind of thing, you know, now anybody can do it, and I think everyone should.
When I was in school, I did dream of doing stuff like this. I mean, you know, Michael Moore's doc, Roger and Me, came out when I was just finishing in the late 80s, early 90s from university. Things like Manufacturing Consent, the documentary on Noam Chomsky, came out. You know, some really good docs. And I used to dream about being able to, with smaller format gear and, you know, no real budget, be able to create something. And we did it. It feels great. And people can do it. It's you know, if we can do it, other people can do it too.
I wanted to also ask you, this is a big project. How long did it take you to do it?
Well, a year.
Yeah, it was about a year of evenings and weekends and you know some time off in the summer. But I have a regular full-time gig that takes up 40, sometimes 50 hours a week, and managed to squeeze it in, you know, with that too. I mean, it's a year out of my life. And you know, you think when you do a project like this, when you're done, you're done. But you know, the year after that has been just as busy with shipping out DVDs and going to screenings and you know, doing radio interviews.
Yeah, becoming, you know, at some level public advocates for this issue and trying to do whatever we can to warn people about this crisis coming.
Just to intercede there, back to the planning process. You're on a limited budget. You have an idea what you want to do. Did you do a lot of storyboarding or you know, what about how did you plan this and put this together? How did you think you would be able to put it together on your limited budget?
Well, it grew organically, I think, out of, you know, I think, A, first and foremost, Barry's tireless work. He has a real ability to put these arguments forward in a very clear and concise way, and he did the lion's share of the how the documentary made sense, you know, very clear and accessible to people, and that's an amazing skill.
I like to think that it's not a skill sometimes, and you know, these things sometimes just come out of the universe somewhere, and you know, you have good fortune. But we were lucky. I think a lot of it happened in the editing process for us. We were lucky to have that freedom to have the equipment for a year and just lay out clips in our timeline along the length of the show and say, well, does this work? Does that work? And move things around. And it was, again, organic is a very good word, as Greg said, a very organic process of you know, letting the story kind of tell itself. The hardest part in the end was just, you know, deciding what to keep and what to throw away, because there was a lot of footage that, you know, we would have liked to have had, but, you know, you just can't have a 10-hour documentary, you know. And, you know, in some cases, you're editing out things that might be a little too political, a little too much of your own editorial, and it's, you know, Greg certainly had to rein me in and say, you know, we would be better off if we just left this out and let people, you know, come to their own conclusions.
Yeah, it's probably one of the hardest parts is to keep your own personal stuff out of it, right?
So they say in editing, you have to kill your babies. Yeah, that's one of the sad truths, but you know, that's sort of where the discipline kicks in, I guess. But that's, you know, we had the luxury of having an edit suite for a year to do this, or you know, 8 months or whatever. 9 months when we started to go into the edit. And the conventional approach for documentaries is you shoot it, and then at the end, you know, you go through this horrible, grief-stricken, ulcer-provoking editorial process, you know. And that model is changing. And I think anybody who can should
move
away.
How is it changing?
Well, because there's like, this is the way our new documentary is being edited right now. Is I have a desktop Macintosh running on Final Cut Pro, which is an editing software, which is great. And I'm logging the footage, and I'm doing preliminary edits, and then I'm going to pass all that off to Barry, you know, as we get closer to the editorial stage. And, you know, my stuff probably won't make much sense, and Barry will make it make sense. But that's how the model's changing, and so we have a flexible model now based on, you know, computer technology. Just a couple of $1,000, cables, the gear, and you have the flexibility to edit as you do the documentary, which is what we did last time.
Are you still using your Canon for this second documentary?
I bought the new Canon. It's called the XL2. It's the new generation, and it's a wonderful camera. It still has a couple of lens problems, but it's got a 16:9. So if anybody who understands, it's like the cinema aspect ratio. So it's not the big sort of square box. It's the sort of narrower look, and it's one of the only cameras in the market that actually has a dedicated CCD chips for that ratio. Other cameras just put a black mask in the top and the bottom, but this one, you're getting the entire picture. It's a beautiful image. It's very cinematic, so it's going to be a very cinematic documentary.
What about the audio part of this? You want to go back? You can go back to End of Suburbia if you want to, Barry, even, and talk about putting the audio in, getting the rights for sound, music, all that end of it.
I think audio I think audio for video is just as important as the picture. And we were very lucky in that I had a close friend who is a composer and was interested in taking this on. One thing that we wanted to do was be able to, you know, edit long before we did any music. So I used what's called a guide track. I would pick a cut of music for whatever I was editing, and most of the time I just went to the internet And I would leave an internet radio station running and just keep a tape handy. And when I heard something that I liked, I would, you know, put it on tape and then throw it into my timeline and edit to it. One of the stations I hooked up with was DroneZone.com, which was playing a lot of ambient music. And in terms of the documentary, we talk about in the documentary something called consensus trance, which is the idea that we all believe that life is going to go on and things are going to be normal just as they ever have, and things are only going to get better and we'll never have any problems. And we wanted the music to kind of reflect that idea of the consensus trance. So trance music turned out to be, the perfect genre of music to do that. So the composer I work with, he can do country and western and dance music, anything you ever wanted.
His name is Ken Van de Vries, and he's incredibly, incredibly talented.
And he works just down the road here in Brantford, and he works just down the road from Hamilton in Brantford. So I would send him, samples of what I had done with his trance music and say, I'd like this, but I'd like a little more like this and a little more like that. And
so he would write it with your indicator. What format was it in that you sent?
Actually, I was working in an edit suite in Toronto, and I would email him QuickTime movies or just MP3 files of what I had done as a sample. And, a couple of days later, he would email me something back and say, well, what do you think of this? And I'd say, well, take this out or make it a little slower, we didn't even have to meet face-to-face in order to do this process, which was, it's an amazing technology to be able to do that. But he's done a fabulous job of creating that trance-like atmosphere. There's and so many subtleties he's put into the music, like... he's taken kind of a little Fistful of Dollars motif, that little whistle, and he's incorporated that into, very subtly into the track. So it has kind of
a sort of Americana. We were looking for something that would have a sort of signature Americana sound to it. And he just nailed it. It was great.
He had the advantage of actually seeing the clip, so that helped him to put this together.
Yeah, but he has, it's the first time he'd taken a project like this on. He has an incredible capacity to compose, and he has a great sense for music.
In some cases, we actually had to encourage him to hold back, because he was so eager to do things. And
we stripped down the tracks, and the bottom was what we used.
Yeah, something, we'd be listening to something going, well, it's right, but it's just not working. And then we'd say, well, just take everything out, but, leave in these two tracks, right? And it was like, bam, he nailed it. So, yeah, being able to restrain people sometimes is for their own good.
What was he working in? What format did he do his tool? What tools was he using?
Did he use Pro Tools?
No, not Pro Tools.
WaveLab?
DigiDesign, I think, or something like that.
DigiDesign?
No, I couldn't.
It wasn't WaveLab, though.
No.
Too bad.
No.
Okay, just curious about
all
that.
All Mac-based, though. No. This was all done on the Macintosh, his computer.
One of the advantages of Macintosh equipment, and of course a lot of independents in this city are running on PC because it's cheaper, so there is some crossover. Do you think there's a soundtrack to End of Suburbia in there someplace? Do you think it could be marketed at some point or even presented as an audio track without the talking heads?
Well, we've actually kind of thrown the idea around of putting out a soundtrack, because it is so easy to do if you have the resources to do it. Certainly, when I was listening to Ken's work, I'd burn a CD and put it in the CD player, on the way to the edit suite, and I'd be listening to it, and yeah, I could actually see that. There have been a lot of spinoff. I want to use the word products, but. We get people asking us for posters and T-shirts and buttons and all these things. So, I could see conceivably how we could do that. We certainly have we have enough popularity with the DVD that people would, recognize the name. But
I think with Escape from Suburbia, my idea is to really go for one sort of clear sound. I've been really moved by the music. I think it's Cliff Martinez, Californian. He does all the soundtracks for the Steven Soderbergh films. So he's done He's done The Limey. He's done Traffic. He did Solaris, the new remake of Solaris. And, you know, he takes sort of found sounds and then mixes them into a very sort of ambient and, you know, sonorous kind of sound, which so I want to, with Escape from Suburbia, I want to have the end of Suburbia was a, you know, a sort of Americana sound. Escape from Suburbia is about, you know, rethinking the American dream globally. That's the metaphor. That's what we're talking about with Escape from Suburbia, Suburbia being the American dream. So escaping that is our reinvention of that. So I want a sort of a global sound. I listen to a lot of Buddha Bar CDs. They're that's sort of it's all a global fusion of music with a lot of Arabic music. And because we're talking a lot about, at the beginning of our documentary, about Saudi Arabia and OPEC production, I think it's going to be, the new soundtrack's going to be heavily influenced by that sort of global fusion of ambient music that's coming out and it's becoming really popular, especially in Europe, but more so here too.
When is it, well, you're working on Escape from Suburbia now. When are you hoping to have it ready for market?
We were saying June or July of this next year, but I think it's going to be August now. We're you know, in that fundraising period. We've shot about a third of the documentary, and we've got to have more funds. So we're looking for more funds. We're looking for a broadcaster. These are things that we didn't do with the end of Suburbia. We were able to go ahead, but I really feel that the sort of the slightly bigger crew of people we're working with now have to get paid. We can't do what we did, Barry and I, again, and ask other people to do it. So I want to get paid too as a director. So that's you know, that's what we're doing now. We're in that fundraising period, and it's a global sense. We're traveling. You know, we want to show examples of alternative energies, as successful examples, but also investigate why that success may not be replicable everywhere in the world. So we're going to go to Iceland. They're at the leading edge of, they're going to have the world's first hydrogen economy within the decade. Why are they going to do it? Well, I mean, you know, technologically, they've been putting a lot of resources in, but they have free energy. Essentially, they have free energy in there in the sense that they, you know, they run their power plants off geothermal energy. So they have, you know, cheap, abundant electricity, and that's what you need for a hydrogen, especially a hydrogen economy. We're not likely to have that in North America because it's too expensive. We consume too much. We're too spread out. We don't have the urban density to bring, you know, the kind of electricity costs that we'd need under control for a hydrogen economy. And then, you know, maybe we'll go to Brazil. We're not sure about that yet. But Brazil is in the leading edge of the biofuel revolution. For 30 years, people don't know this, but for 30 years they've increased, you know, the use of ethanol and methanol in their vehicles. Is that the global answer? Clearly it isn't, because we don't have enough biomass to continue, you know, burning the kind of oil we have for the past 50 years. So we give examples of success, and then, you know, we investigate what, you know, how that success may not be a global model. So we're traveling a bit around the world. We want to go to, you know, Saudi Arabia and investigate the claims by independent analysts that, you know, they may be on the verge of a production collapse. So it's, and in China, we're looking at how China will continue to fuel their economic miracle. That's a real center point for the documentary because everything hinges on that. If their economy begins to wane, then that's the end of, global affluence for a while. And that's certainly going to be an outcome if we hit this peak oil within the next few years. There's no way that China will be able to continue to fuel its economic expansion, and that is going to be catastrophic for them and catastrophic for the world.
You mentioned all these countries. Are you going to use your? You're going to be using your music to set the stage for these different countries, do you think?
Yeah, I think there's going to be sort of a default global, you know, soundtrack which we can pick elements out of. wherever we are. So if we're in Brazil, there'll be a sort of Brazilian element to that soundtrack, which we're going to be able to pull out of Saudi Arabia. We'll have an Arab or maybe a Rai music component that we'll be able to pull out of. That's what we're looking at.
Are you thinking of using local music while you record in that country?
I always do that. I always, talk to street musicians and performers and see if it's possible to use what they're doing as a sort of a context for... I always do that. We didn't do that with The End of Suburbia, but Escape from Suburbia is really telling people's stories around the world. We're not... we're interviewing the experts, but we're also... telling the stories of community leaders around the world who are really recognizing what's coming and pioneering alternatives to petroleum. So it's in telling those stories, we're taking a different approach, and we're sort of on the street with people.
So it sounds like a totally different approach that you're more artistically approaching this project, this second version of Escape from Suburbia, with putting the music in the forefront of the plan rather than fitting what you shot visually?
No, it's the same approach. We're going to go to Ken after and get that. But, I think I have a clear sense this time around of where I want to go and whatever. I'm growing up, I guess, as a filmmaker somewhat. But... this is going to be more of a conventional documentary approach. Barry and I did, I think, an activist documentary, and we've given the world a tool that can prime people about what's coming and provoke debate and discussion. This documentary will be, this approach is more of a traditional documentary format where we're, trying to track people's struggles. There's a sort of stories of how people are using, also how people are using our documentary around the world to change public opinion. Our first documentary features in this second documentary because it's a meme. It's a virus in that sense that's spreading around the world, influencing public policy, beginning to influence public policy, but also people in that sort of cross pollinization process that's going on between all these different groups. So we're tracking how peak oil is changing the nature of the sustainability movement, and so we're telling stories this time. It's a more conventional documentary approach.
This might be unique. You're actually filming the reaction to your original production.
Yeah, who gets to do that? It's yeah. it's really
sounds very cool.
Yeah,
maybe we'll start a whole new genre.
That's it, the suburbia genre.
Well, Michael Moore did the documentary about himself making a documentary. We'll be doing the documentary about what we did after we made a documentary.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, it's very postmodern.
So you're going for a more commercial market on this one. I'm assuming you're looking for more money. You're tightening it up. You're being more mainstream.
Well,
more artist-like rather than activists.
No less activist. In fact, what we're doing is we're featuring the activists. But my ideal, our audience for this documentary is this Escape from Suburbia is more attuned to and I want to get out to soccer moms. That's who I want to approach, because people are going to have to make decisions over the coming decade for the future of their own children and for their own, sake. But, if we can get, as we have been getting, right-wing people saying the same thing as the progressive movement and finally get the progressive movement agreeing on a few things, because that's the problem. The progressive movement just keeps shooting itself in the foot. We say we believe in democracy, but yet we don't really listen to other people's perspectives, or we dismiss them, or, we're intolerant of them, or we're too politically correct or uptight or whatever, So by getting people to agree on the nature of a coming crisis, not necessarily on all the details about what to do about it, but the fact irrefutably that it's coming and that we have to prepare for it. It's an incredible opportunity to bring these groups together, the progressive movement together, but also to reach out to the mainstream and really show them the case for becoming aware and really trying to do what's best for the next generation of children, not necessarily out of a desire to make the world a better place, even, but out of self-interest, out of necessity.
These countries that you're going to be going to, I mean, you've picked these for a reason, right? Is the budget stopping you from picking certain locations, and are you going to Cuba too? Or?
Oh yeah, Cuba's definitely on the list. I'll give you the sort of quick list. Iceland for hydrogen, Spain for solar. They're very interesting solar projects going on there. We're obviously not going to tackle everything, but China, because that it's such a central part of what's going to happen in the coming decades. Across the U.S. and across Canada. We've shot in Washington and New York. I'm going to be shooting in Maine and Colorado and Oregon and California, and probably a bunch of places that I'm not even aware of yet. Of course, Ontario is going to feature predominantly, because I think Ontario is a jurisdiction that has the same problems as a number of other jurisdictions in around the world. So we're a universal cautionary tale. We're hitting in Ontario the limits of our electricity generation. We've hit that, and we don't know how to proceed because we don't want to build coal power stations. The nuclear lobby is coming on, and they want to build lots of nuclear plants at tremendous expense and environmental cost for the next 30,000 years of waste, radioactive waste. So there's huge choices to be made in Ontario that will have to be made in jurisdictions all around the world. So we want to have a local component to the documentary. And so we'll get a sense of what's happening around the world. I mean, the material, the subject matter is just so vast that we have to struggle for simplicity. And, I fully expect to have a very ulcerous time of the edit, as we have to decide what stays and what goes.
You forgot. I can't believe you forgot Saudi Arabia.
Saudi Arabia, we're there. We're so there. One of the interesting things that came out of, I was at the ASPO conference that we shot for at the end of Suburbia. It took place in Lisbon in May, and I shot that. And so I shot all the people we had in our first documentary there, and then the ministers of the environment for all these different countries who attended briefly, former ministers of the environment. Ed Schreier was there representing Canada too, which was great. What was really interesting about the ASPO conference this year was that people were really talking about Saudi Arabia, and that in no part is in no small part is due to Matt Simmons' book, but all eyes are on Saudi Arabia and the Middle East right now, because when OPEC reaches officially the limits of its production, of its daily sustainable, production, then we know we're in trouble. And that may be coming quite soon. I met a fellow who lives in the Arab Emirates, and we might go to the Arab Emirates too. He's a very interesting fellow. He's been, he has a solar business in the Middle East, a couple of shops, and his biggest clients are Afghanis. And he has a very interesting story to tell about, the liberty, the power that having an energy source gives you, having electricity that you can get from the sun. So countries that are failed states like Afghanistan, without a grid, without a functioning grid, what he's selling in his philosophy is that it allows people to live and to develop in appropriate and sustainable ways. And so that's a very important part of our documentary.
So anti-corporate of him.
Well, it takes corporations to make these solar panels, and they're probably all going to get bought out by GE. So,
Yeah, they'll find a way to market in there someplace. So this is a whole different approach for this. Not a whole different. Maybe it's a trilogy. Maybe you guys are actually working on a trilogy.
Well, funny you should mention that. I am thinking of a third doc, because one of the things that comes out of this is the sort of what's it called? The
delusion?
Well, yeah. Well, there's a delusion that many people have that there is, you know, there is one plan B that's going to save us, whether it's cold fusion technology or UFO energy or whatever. There's lots of wonderful conspiracy theories about, you know, technologies that have been suppressed, the suppressed technologies. So I was thinking of doing a little, each documentary, you know, takes a sort of cue from pop culture. The End of Suburbia took our cues from the 50s. Escape from Suburbia is taking its cues from the 1970s. We're going to have some wonderful 70s footage. We're hopefully going to get the rights to a 70s disco hit, More and More and More, which was one of my favorites, and it bespeaks what happened.
So now we know what kind of music to expect from this.
More and More and More. I mean, that's what happened coming out of the 70s, is we were supposed to take these things more responsibility, and then, you know, Reagan got on TV and said, it's still morning in America. And, you know, America went back on its rampage, and, you know, that led in the 90s to the SUV craze. So that we're looking at, you know, an escape from suburbia at the 70s and how the 70s crisis, you know, began to change our habits, but then didn't, because, you know, Americans didn't want to do that. And there's always people who are ready to, you know, tell people what they want to hear. And Reagan did that very well. And I'm thinking as a third film to use some of those sort of B sci-fi films, especially from the 50s. So I want to do a film called Plan B from Outer Space, which is basically all the sort of crazy, you know, technologies that are going to save us, and the, you know, the suppressed technologies.
That'll make our Steve Hayes very happy for his morning Saturday morning shows on movie music, because he does a lot. His theme is from Doctor Who.
Oh, I love, yeah, great. Yeah, well, I was thinking, obviously, of Plan 9 from Outer Space, the Ed Wood film. So Plan B from Outer Space is probably looking what the third film in our trilogy is going to be. But, you know, these all lead to the same inevitable conclusions that, you know, whether you like it or not, whether that's, you know, sort of Kropotkin-style, anti-authoritarian, you know, small-scale village life is what you want, or is anathema to you. It's what's coming. Because we're caught in this progress trap where we cannot see the limits to, you know, our petroleum dependency, and we're not going to be ready for when it starts to fall apart.
We're just about out of time on this segment of this part of this show. You said this second documentary will be done probably August 07 and
06, yeah.
06.
Yeah.
06, okay.
Yeah, a year from now.
Lost a whole year there. That shows you where my head's at. Hopefully you'll be back. When it comes to the screening for End of Suburbia on the 15th of October, are either one of you gentlemen going to be at the screening itself?
Yeah, one or both of us will be there. Depends if I'm out and about, but I think I may be here. Depends on funding. If we have funding for our documentary, then I won't be here.
Oh, I see. Oh, this, I just heard about this now, this funding part. Well, I'll have to think that over. But I have a feeling that what you were saying, trying to get a lot of local groups from different backgrounds interested, I think you're going to see a lot of that happening, hopefully.
Oh, I hope to be here for it, and I really hope that you know, the student movement and the progressive movement in Hamilton can come together for this.
Great. Well, I want to thank once again both these gentlemen for being here, Barry Silverthorne and Greg Green. And they are the joint editors, producer, and writer of End of Suburbia. And if you haven't seen it, watch it on a Saturday night or a Friday night so you've got the weekend to recover before Monday. Thanks very much, gentlemen.
Have a good stiff drink on standby.
Yeah. Thanks very much, gentlemen.
Thanks, Maggie.
Thanks, Maggie.